Welcome to Next Us 818 Podcast, a reflective platform for connecting past successes with future progress in the African American community. I am your host, Dr. JC. I'm excited to launch the new year with more amazing interviews featuring descendants of the 6888 Central Postal Directory Battalion, the only all African American, all female battalion to serve in the European Theater of Operations during World War II. I am pleased to welcome to Episode 9 two descendants of Private First Class Annie Knight Jordan, who served in the 6888. My guests tonight are Dr. Karen Jordan and Dr. Courtney Jordan Cox, the daughter and granddaughter of Annie Knight Jordan. Welcome, Karen and Courtney.
Thank you.
Yes. Hello. Thank you.
I'd like to start with a few interesting facts. First, Annie had a very unique specialty in the Army. She was referred to as a code breaker, and we're going to discuss that shortly. Second, she wrote a short autobiography about her Army service, and I'm going to ask you to share some passages from that during our conversation tonight. And third, all of Annie's female descendants have terminal degrees. Those are pretty intriguing facts, which we will explore some more. Now let's talk about Annie Knight Jordan. First, let's go back to the beginning. She was born in Owsley, Georgia, outside of Valdosta, spent her early years in Tampa, I understand, before she settled in Washington, D.C. So Karen, how old was she when she enlisted?
It looks like she enlisted shy of 25 years old. Okay. She was born in 1918. She went in 1943.
Okay. What was she doing at the time?
Well, after she got out of high school, she had gone to a business school, Cortez Peters, and I guess got some kind of training in secretarial work. And so she had worked for the Social Security Administration in Baltimore, and she had worked for the Commerce Department in D.C., Washington, D.C., and she'd worked for the district government. So she'd done that the first 5 years after she got out of college.
So she must have been one of the very first employees of the Social Security Administration, because the Social Security Administration was very new at that time.
I imagine that it probably was. She used to talk about, you know, how they would, it was in Baltimore, and she used to talk about how they would carpool, a bunch of the young women would carpool and go up there and work. So yeah, I mean, they may have been the first group that actually worked up there.
Okay. So what did she tell you about why she decided to enlist?
She always said that she just felt like doing what she was doing was kind of boring, and that there must be something else in life that I can do, something different. And I know she wanted to go to college, but her family was not able to afford that at the time. So my thought is that she probably felt like she was in kind of in dead end type of jobs, and she wanted some excitement. And I guess she couldn't go to college, so she wanted to try something different. And she had a girlfriend named Ruth, who I'm assuming must have been a coworker slash girlfriend. And as what I know about that era, they were recruiting around that time. They were recruiting women into the military. I guess it was the Women's Army Corps at that time, Women's Auxiliary Army Corps at that time. And apparently, from things I've read in various from other sources, they were actively looking for women. So it was advertised in various places about women joining the Army. So she went to her, I guess she must have read or seen an advertisement, and she went to her girlfriend Ruth and said, "We're going in the Army." And of course, her girlfriend thought the whole thing was funny, but I guess she was able to talk her into it because both of them did join.
Okay. So Courtney, do you remember anything your grandmother told you about her decision to enlist?
My recollection is pretty similar. And I didn't learn a lot about her service until after she passed. So one of the major things that helped fill the gaps in for me was reading the things that she wrote about her life and her service. When she passed, I think she left everything exactly the way she wanted it, the way that she wanted her legacy to be written and things that she wanted to be known. So that's how I found out about the magnitude of her service. I knew she served. I just didn't know what it ultimately meant. So some of these details I learned about as we have gone and learned about not just her, but about our family lineage in general.
Okay. So Annie had three brothers who were already in the army at the time. How did her parents react when she told them she was going to enlist, Karen?
Well, I remember her saying that three of them were in, and her parents were not too thrilled about her going in too. And so the way she got her mother and father to kind of buy into it is to say, because her brothers were fighting. I mean, they were active duty. And I believe during World War II, people were drafted just like they were in Vietnam. So they might have been drafted, I don't know. But they were actually in Europe and they were actually on the front lines. And I think she was a girl, you know, she was their daughter, the youngest daughter. So I imagine they were pretty terrified about her saying, I'm going into the military. So in order to get them to buy into it, she promised that she would not go to Europe, as if she had a choice about that. But I guess being young and naive, you're thinking, well, I could just tell them what I want. You know, I don't want to go to Europe. I want to go somewhere with my girlfriend. I don't, you know, which, you know, nothing turned out the way she thought it was going to.
So it was a pretty courageous thing for a young Black woman to enlist in the Army in the 40s. What do you think made her special?
I don't know I think what made it different for her is that she was ambitious. Two things, like I said, you know, when you want, a person who in that era who wanted to go to college, first of all, was ambitious. And then when you couldn't do it because you couldn't afford it, then you look for another alternative, again, because you're ambitious, you want to be more than you are, you want to do something different, you want to advance in your career. And so I think that's what the ambition, and I think there was you look at these women, they were all in their early 20s, late teens, and if we all think about how we were at that age, we were looking for new things and adventures, and we may have gotten them through going to college. We may have gotten them other ways, but I look at these women the way I look at myself as a young woman. And yes, I wanted to do things. I wanted to experience the world. I wanted to get away from home. I wanted to, you know, meet all kinds of different people. And so I think these women, and she did the same thing. This was her way of getting out there in the world and enjoying and experiencing the world as a young single woman.
So I'm interested in any stories that she shared about her time in the service, any adventures or painful, scary, or funny memories. So I understand that in her autobiography, she wrote about her overseas training, about being housed in a horse stable in Scotland, and about adventures in and around England and France. Can you please share some of those experiences that she wrote about or that she told you about?
One of the things she wrote about, and there are other experiences, by the way, that she wrote about some stateside experiences, but she also wrote about the experience when she was selected to go to the European Theater of Operations. Once she was, I guess you have to be selected for that, for the overseas training. And she said when she went to Fort Gruber for the overseas training, that she had to go through extensive training. They had to go through gas chambers. They had intensive physical training. They were climbing ropes as if, you know, you were on to abandoning a ship. And they were outfitted with all kinds of additional equipment that she didn't need when she was stateside. And as I read that, I thought about how young women today, as soon as you go in the military, you probably do all of that with basic training. But I guess these ladies didn't expect to. They were really trained as real soldiers. So she mentions that. But she also mentions other stories, too, about the military. I know one of the ones that she had in her album, she talked about how she, I guess, had not done something right. I don't know, some assignment that she had. And I don't know whether it was her quarters weren't up to par or whatever. Clothing, something was off. And, you know, in the military, everything that you do that's out of line, there's a consequence. And she spoke about how she had her consequence was that she had to clean, I think it was windows or something outside in the cold as a punishment for breaking some rule. And she mentioned how that was. And sometimes you would be assigned to things like KP and latrine duty too. I guess if you didn't do everything exactly the Army way.
So the notion of the being the right way in the Army way?
Yes. And I've read from and heard with many of the other women, they talk about that whole thing about the linen and how you had to do had to miter the corners of your bed and had how you had to make it so tight that a quarter would bounce off of it. And she told that story, as did some of the other women in their recollections of what their experience. They talked about the same thing about, you know, there was the Army way and you had to do stuff the Army way, period, like it or not. Apparently, when they first got to England, they had to stay in the old converted horse stables. My assumption is that the King George School was probably not ready for them yet. So they had to stay in those stables and they had to bathe with their helmets. They had to bathe with cold water in their helmets because they didn't have sinks. So they had to rough it.
So I gather that she took advantage of, there were a lot of adventures while she was over there. She got to visit a lot of places that she had dreamed of as a child, the Pyrenees Mountains. Talk about some of her.
I don't know about dreaming of as a child. I don't know if she dreamt of them as a child, but they were experiences that she had. Now, I noticed a consistent thing that I've heard from some of the other women that went, some of the surviving women. They talk about how the British people accepted them more readily than in this country that people of color would have been accepted. So they didn't seem to have the same biases against the women of color, and they respected the fact that they were in the military and that meant something. And so she does mention in her autobiography that when she was in Birmingham, they actually got to go out into the community with the native people, and they would have tea and coffee and stuff, and they'd get to know them. And then, of course, she mentions how when she was in Paris, she really seemed to have a good time. She also mentioned, you know, they dated, they met a lot of the male soldiers, and she has pictures of a lot of them in her scrapbook. They dated guys, they went out socially, I have a little, looks like an invitation to a club. So I'm assuming they probably were going to some kind of party in France. And she also visited the Pyrenees Mountains in southern France. She always talked about how she waded in the Mediterranean Sea. She said she attended the Grand Opera, Moulin Rouge. She visited the Arc de Triomphe and she strolled along Pigalle, I guess it's called. She was in France and Paris. It sounds like in Paris was where she had the most opportunity to explore. And then, of course, she was only there for 5 months and she went back. Then that was toward the end of their duty, their assignment, and she came back home.
I think Courtney had a question for you, I think.
Oh, what is Kate?
Yes, it's an old question at this point now, but earlier on, Aunt Karen, you mentioned using helmets to wash and something called KP. Did I hear that correctly?
Yes. Now, I'm not really sure exactly what kitchen patrol, kitchen police, but that was kitchen duty. Exactly what the KP stands for, but one of those things. But it was kitchen duty, you know, peeling the potatoes, cooking the food, cleaning the dishes, mopping the floor in the kitchen. It was all kitchen duty. And, of course, latrine duty was cleaning the bathrooms. Nobody wanted to do that.
I can imagine how much fun that was.
Yeah, those were the least favorite jobs, because you have to remember, most of these women went into the military, a lot of them went in with some kind of a skill set, and they also went in with the idea that they would learn something. And so, unfortunately, because they were African-American people, they always tended to assign them to the menial type jobs. And these ladies thought they were going to be learning something new and something different. So nobody wanted to do KP or latrine duty. I guess they kind of reserved those as sort of punishment for you if you didn't do something right.
Yeah, I would imagine that every soldier has experienced something like that in the course of their service, where, you know, there's some things that they need to do that are just a part of the gig, but perhaps in this case magnified by race and gender being overlapped on top of that.
Yes, because if you read, there's several books written about the experience these ladies had, and that was one of the problems that some of the women had to face. I don't want to digress into other women's stories, but that seemed to be a common thing. These women wanted to grow. You know, even now when you hear advertisements about the Army, you know, go in the Army and you learn how to fly, you learn how to do this and you learn how to do that. I don't think they pushed that as much back then, but all these women thought that they were going to either be able to use the skills they had or that they were going to learn new skills. But I don't think they thought they were going to go into the military and do domestic work, because they were doing that outside and that's what they were getting away from.
So let me, I want to switch gears a little bit. Recently, you learned that Annie had a very unique and special classification in the Army. Even though the 6888 was a postal battalion, her Army classification was actually Cryptographic Code Compiler, AKA Codebreaker. So in that role, she had special training and secret clearance. There were virtually no Black women selected for this role, and their identities have been mostly unknown. Courtney, what exactly is a cryptographic code compiler?
Great question, because I am just figuring this out myself. So a person in this role gathers and prepares data to be used in the cryptanalytic solutions of enemy messages. They prepare and assist in compiling the messages, revising code books, cipher systems, and cipher keys for use in safeguarding military communications.
Sounds like a very impressive and confidential job that your grandmother had. So why don't you share with us, I think in her autobiography she wrote to describe her assignment.
Can you? Sure. So she says that my second station was Camp Gruber, Oklahoma. It was here I did cryptography. Whenever secret messages came in at night, a chauffeur-driven car would transport me to the office where I was secured inside of a special room where messages were coded and decoded using Morse code. Following that, the messages were burned and the equipment locked in a safe.
What was your reaction? I'm going to ask you first, Karen. What was your reaction when you found out that your mother was a code breaker? And then I'm going to ask you, Courtney, for your reaction also.
Well, I was impressed because I didn't realize what a unique specialty that was. I mean, she would sometimes talk about Morse code and how she learned Morse code and she cracked Morse code, but she never, I never got the, understood the importance of what she was doing. So I was quite impressed when we found out that that was a unique experience for an African-American woman. I've done a little research since then, and apparently there was one group of African-American women assigned to a place in Washington, D.C. that did this, but I didn't realize the uniqueness of her assignment.
And Courtney, when you found out?
I mean, this sounds kind of cool, like top secret spy espionage. No, not that, not quite that far, but it clearly means that she was trusted and respected, and that she had some special training that differentiated her from her peers. So I can only imagine how exciting it must have been, but also maybe nerve-wracking in certain instances to be chauffeured personally by car to decode these messages. I haven't served in the military myself, so I don't know the intricacies of how all of these things are done, but it sounds like a pretty cool assignment. It's just different.
Very impressive.
Well, I would imagine it was a whole lot better than KP and latrine duty. but you're right. It was quite a unique experience. And I would imagine that it was exciting. And she actually did say that kind of work was exciting, because if you had to be selected to do that. From what I've read, you had to be screened and selected to do that. They didn't just let everybody do it. So that was an honor. And she must have exhibited some special skills. She talked about operating whatever the TWX machine was. I'm assuming she came there with very strong office skills from having worked in various government organizations and having had extra post-high school training in office type work. But they must have seen something in her when she came into the military, because they didn't let everybody do that. There was screening that they did. And there were criteria you had to meet in order to get into that group.
I would also imagine they may have seen her as a person who had a high level of attention to detail, right? Like these messages, if somebody bothers to code a message, that means it's probably something pretty important or critical to the work that the military was doing at the time. And so they must have really, really trusted her and seen something special.
Well, if you remember, I remember my mother's personality. And yes, she was a stickler for detail and doing stuff the right way. And, I remember as a student growing up, your papers had to be perfect, your grammar had to be perfect, your diction had to be perfect. She was very meticulous about that kind of stuff. And I thought it was because she'd worked for the government and had worked in office environments, but now I realize part of it may have been working in this environment as a cryptographer. But yes, she was very funny about detail, about doing jobs the right way and paying attention to detail. Absolutely.
Well, gosh, I don't know anybody else in our family who's like that.
It didn't come down through the DNA. Oh, well.
It must have fallen out of the sky.
One of the genes fell off, right? One of the limbs of the gene fell off.
Let me ask you this. What did Annie do when she completed her military service, and how did she use the GI Bill? Not everyone, because not everybody had apparently had access to the GI Bill. And so I'm just curious, it's my understanding that Annie actually did take full advantage of the GI Bill. So you want to
Yeah,
talk
she
about that?
did. I do know that some of the descendants reported that their mothers or aunts and grandmothers weren't able to get that. But again, she was the go-getter, and so yeah, she used that GI Bill to fulfill her dream, because her real dream was to get a college education. And with her parents not being able to afford it, then now with the GI Bill, she was able to use that to pursue her dream of a college education. In her autobiography, she does mention that year that she started school was the largest enrollment that she went to Howard, and that was the largest enrollment that they'd ever had graduating. That was the largest graduating class. And because a lot of the soldiers had returned from the military and were using their GI Bill. So they were running around to all of the, particularly HBCUs. They were blossoming because everybody was going around to get their degrees after they got out of college, which I think is fabulous that they did that. She also we know that she also purchased a home, even though she lived with her parents. She also purchased a home after she got out of the military and was a landlord, essentially, because she did have a tenant. So, and you think for women of that era, she, well, I guess that experience going to Europe made her more independent and more assertive. And she came back here and she got all her benefits and she used them.
And she met someone special at Howard.
Well, she met our father. So it's the way we got here. And then sort of indirectly how Courtney got here. But yeah, they met at Howard. Yeah, through a Catholic club.
And that's what the Newman Club?
The Newman Club. Yeah, they met through the Newman Club. And then they got married, and then she moved to Savannah. And that's where she lived for almost 60 years before she died. We think close to 60 years. Oh, maybe over that. Yes.
I do remember a story, and now I can't remember where it comes from reading stuff and talking to folks, things have jumbled a little bit, but I do remember her saying that she met Grandpa at the Newman Club. She'd been going to several meetings, and they were both, I think, executive board officers. One may have been the secretary, the other might have been like a treasurer, and she approached him asking for notes from a meeting. And that was a piece of how they sparked their conversation. I don't know if she had plans when she approached him to talk about that, but that was one story that I remember about them interacting.
I think he had the plans, because
Okay.
there was a priest who was their advisor, and my father, being the person that he was, he talked the priest into talk being his wingman. he used the priest as his wingman to get her, you know, to get her to, you know, go out with him.
So do you recall any lessons that she learned in her service that she passed on to the family? Are there any values or traditions that she passed on as a consequence of her service?
I think that one of the things that I guess came out of her experience, but it also was probably a part of who she was, is that you know, she had two daughters, and I never felt like she was the kind of woman that felt that women should be limited, even though she was for the most part of her life a housewife, but she was always pursuing other things. I mean, she went to Catholic University and got some more training. She did training in the local colleges. She was always getting more skills and more knowledge. And so, you know, some kids, some young women, and even as late as our generation, I mean, I'm in the baby boomer generation, sometimes the mothers weren't that, and the fathers didn't push the daughters quite as much. Now, the baby boomers, that's when they started pushing women to do things. But coming from a mother who did that back in the day when it wasn't as accepted for women to be out and about, I never felt like, I always felt like she encouraged and supported her daughters in their pursuit of higher learning and bigger careers. So you always got the sense that she felt like women could do whatever they wanted to do. So you felt like you were pushed by both your mother and your father, and that you would, it was never, well, women can only do this, or you ought to just look for a husband or anything. Like, I never felt like she pushed us that way.
I think so many things that she had done leading up to being a parent were so far out of the norm for a Black woman in that time. And so I think that no matter what, she would have seen it as important for her children and descendants to get an education and be out of the norm and be exceptional in whatever time and place that they're living in. So I definitely feel the same. I get, even as a grandchild, I get the same lesson.
Yeah, it seemed like it has always seemed to me in the family that, you know, how some families have different expectations of the boys than they do the girls. And I never felt like that was the way our family was. I always felt like the expectations were the same, that the women could accomplish as much as the sons could. The daughters could accomplish as much as the sons could. So you didn't, there wasn't that gender structure. And I've heard about families where that was true. You know, the girls were encouraged to get a man and the sons were encouraged to get a career. But even though my mother was a housewife most of her years when we were growing up, she didn't seem to want to hold us back. I never felt that.
And I guess she was very civically engaged.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's the other thing, too, that I think coming, I think that these women having had the adventures that they did, I noticed when I've read some of the other books, a lot of the women came back to their communities and they were very active in their communities. And I remember as a small child, as a young child, my mother was very active in her sorority. So I guess I got a shout out for Sigma Gamma Rho. And she was very active with that. And she was very, and she and my father were very active with the NAACP and the civil rights movement. And they were, I remember later on, and a lot of people don't remember this, there was you had to, there were people that were being trained. This was during the threat of nuclear war. I think they were called civil defense something. And she took the training for that. And these were people that if they were trained that if we ended up, this was like during the Bay of Pigs and some issues with Cuba, and they were trained to be the community leaders if we were to have a war. And so you had to have special training. And she took that training. So she was always trying to do something else, learn something else. She just never stopped trying to grow and develop.
So let's segue now, Karen and Courtney, and we'll talk about you and your family. You have a very interesting family with four generations of doctoral educated men and women. That's impressive. So tell me about your respective careers and backgrounds. Karen first, and then Courtney.
Well, I have two doctorates. I went to graduate school at Howard and got my doctorate in biochemical pharmacology. And then I also went to a medical school. And so I have my degree in medicine from Wayne State University. And I think I've told people this, I know I've told this story before, but when I was as a young woman talking about careers and I would mention, well, maybe I'll be a secretary. My mother would say, no, well, you know, you really won't make a whole lot of money. You won't advance and you don't need a lot of education for that. So she kind of discouraged that. And then I said, well, maybe I'll be a nurse. And she said, well, you know, I mean, women can be doctors too. You can always be a doctor. So it was again, that whole thing of you can be whatever you want to be. There's no restriction. I guess I always heard that voice in the back of my head, but you can be whatever you want to be. And so that's what I did.
Okay. Courtney?
Yeah. So I have a PhD in organizational leadership. I have had a career, the first part of my career was spent working in public service and nonprofits doing counseling. And then now in my, I can't even say the second half of my career, because I don't think we're at the halfway mark yet based on what's in my retirement fund. But this part of my current, this current part of my career, I am working as a higher education administrator.
Okay. So Karen, tell me about your siblings. You have two siblings.
Well, my sister also has her doctorate, and she is both a retired university administrator, and she's also a retired judge. So again, it's, you know, another thing with women going as far as you want, doing whatever you want to do. And again, we were raised with that kind of mentality to do what you want to do, to keep growing and keep doing and keep developing. And my brother also is, again, I think about, and he's more like a social activist kind of person. And I guess in a way that stems, you could see how my parents' involvement in community when we were all younger may have stirred that up in him. So he works for the ACLU, and he's been with them for a number of years. Okay. So, you know, again, that's sort of a family thing. You got to be out there. You got to be doing things. You got to be making the world a better place.
So how many members of your family served in the military? I know you mentioned your mother's three brothers, but were there other members of the family in the military?
Well, actually, on both sides of the family, I guess pretty much everybody other than, you know, when the baby boomers came, we weren't, well, we were drafted. Of course, some people were drafted for Vietnam, but I think after Vietnam, the attitude toward the military may have changed a bit. But the World War II group and the Korean conflict group, I think everybody pretty much, my mother's two brothers, my mother had five siblings. The two oldest daughters did not go to the military, but all three of the sons were drafted into the military. So that's my three uncles. And then on my father's side, he was involved in the Korean conflict. He was a captain in the army. And then his two brothers were also in the army. And I believe his uncle was also in the army at some point. I may be wrong about that. I guess that would have probably been World War I or something, or in between the two world wars. But so pretty much everybody, all the adults, it was almost like a rites of passage back in that era. And even now, well, we have one first cousin who was in the army for, I think, about 6 years. And we have another second cousin once removed who was just promoted to a full bird colonel. And she's particularly interested in the 6888 story because she has she's very clear about how these women paved the way for her to be who she is. So she feels honored to know that she has a relative that, you know, opened the doors for her.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about influence. All of Annie's female descendants have a PhD, MD, or JD, which is quite impressive. In what ways Annie's service in the 6888 influenced that career drive and focus, do you think?
But I might defer to the younger generation about that, because it's something that has passed on. And I would be curious to know how the younger generation might feel like what was the message that they got?
I'd say the message that I got was to do your best, maximize your potential. And if I could take a couple of steps back at a higher level view, it's really to prepare yourself for self-sufficiency, not necessarily relying on systems or even a spouse to be able to help you do what you need to do to get from childhood and where everything is prepared for you and given to you to the later stages of your adulthood. You have to take an active role, particularly as a woman, particularly as a Black person. It actually becomes even more important to take an active role in what you want your future to be and what you want it to look like. So you can't leave things to chance. Many things have to be kind of planned and calculated with some attention to detail, possibly, so that you can get the things that you want out of life and really be able to enjoy life at the next level, not just surviving, but thriving.
And you know, again, if we go back, step back a generation, with my mother's decision to join the military, it's a little different from the world that we live in today, but it was still with that same kind of mentality. You know, I'm going to be self-sufficient. My parents don't necessarily agree, but I'm going out here and I'm going to, you know, face the world. I'm going to experience things. I'm going to try to improve my life. I'm going to have adventures, and I'm going out and doing it, even though, you know, maybe everybody doesn't think it's a good idea. So it essentially, it's kind of the same mindset that I think has passed on down. No ones of the females in her family did anything after or because of or with a man per se. Not that that's a bad thing, but just that, you know, again, it was like, this is what I want to do for myself as a woman. And that's what we all did. And even the younger generation, Courtney, your generation, you all did stuff on your own as an independent woman.
I'll also add that I think one thing that the women of our family, I would say all of the descendants, but particularly the women probably picked up, is it's okay to go away from home and do your thing. Like, whatever your thing is, you don't have to stay in your hometown. You're not trapped in the state that you live in. You're free to pursue opportunities, even if it's different and scary and unknown, right? It's not, you're not limited. And as I look at it's 2023 now. Even as I look around me at my peers and my friends, I see some fear and some hesitancy in going out of their hometown and home area, not being emotionally prepared to take a step away and to pursue things that are new and probably also somewhat frightening. But in my family, even when it comes time to like go away to college, I didn't think, oh my gosh, I can't go halfway across the country. I thought to myself, of course I can. Why shouldn't I go halfway across the country? College is a time to explore things. And so that's where I went. And I've noticed that folks in my family have very much, through education and through job opportunities, very much done the same thing, not being fearful of branching out where others may stay local and possibly risk being underexposed to the world.
Well, as you were talking about that, you know, when I was applying to college, it was my mother who took me all around, and she always wanted me to go to away to school to experience something different. I remember she took me to every place I got accepted. She was the one who took me there to experience the school, to learn about the school. And so, right, there was that sense of, yes, you get out there, go, you know, see the world, do your thing. And that came from the maternal side as much as it did the paternal side.
My mother also did the same thing, took me to see all the various colleges and all the places that I applied to. Again, almost all of them being at least halfway across the country from home, at least.
And, you know, I think about that as a parent now myself with grown children. I think about that I look at my grandmother, Mama Knight, and Papa Knight, and their daughter going into the military, and how frightening that must have been for them. And but yet they didn't stop her or try to stop her, and they seem to have supported it. And then, of course, stepped down a generation, and our parents had to do the same thing. You know, they had to support us in our stepping out into the world and experiencing the world. And then, of course, you guys, the generation behind, you know, we passed that same kind of way of thinking. Get out there and experience the world.
Oh, how old was Annie when she passed?
She was 91. She would have been 92 that very year.
And so I understand she's one of the only 14 6888 soldiers buried in Arlington National Cemetery?
Yes. And that was something she always talked about. There were a couple of things that she talked about quite a bit. She always talked about the postal work that they did, you know, and in Europe, and also the adventures that they had. But she always said that she was determined to be buried in Arlington. And she actually even had that in her will. She had actually made all the arrangements to be buried there. But it's specific, it's stipulated in her will even.
It's an honor to be buried there.
Interesting, if I can add just one quick thing. It's interesting that that was such an important thing for her, because it's really about being able to be honored and acknowledged alongside others who have served the nation in a significant and powerful way. A lot of times women and Black people, especially Black women, have not gotten that opportunity to be honored and seen for the things that we do, for the sacrifices that we make, for the ways in which we pioneer things in the world or set the tone for all others to come behind us. So I think that says something about her desire to really be seen, even in death, to be seen as a woman of impact.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then, you know, as we look back, I've heard stories of some of the descendants and some of the women never getting their benefits or having to fight for them. And I think the whole thing with being buried at Arlington is a continuation of that. I'm getting my benefits. And she did. You know, she made sure she got her educational benefits, her housing benefits, and I'm going to get my burial benefits. And she was determined to make all of that work out.
I also understand she had to take on the Army to make sure she got some of her other benefits, for some of her health benefits.
Yeah, she ended up with some disability benefits. She had had some hip problems in the military. I know she used to talk about how they marched so much, and she was starting to have hip pain. So as she got older, she actually also went for her disability benefits, because that same hip that she had had trouble with while she was in the military later subsequently became a problem as time went on in life. And yes, she went all the way to DC to get her medical benefits that she was due.
So as I heard the story, she was denied the benefits, and being who she was not going to accept no for an answer, because
yes,
many people get their request rejected. And so she went to DC to make sure she got the benefits that would do her.
Absolutely. Yep. She went all the way to DC to make sure she got all of her benefits.
Right. So please share your reflections you have on what her life and her legacy mean to you and the family, as you kind of think broadly. And that's for each of you.
Just a funny story really quickly. I've also heard from my mother that sometimes you just have to show up and get stuff done. You can't do things over the phone. You can't send a bunch of emails. Sometimes you just got to show up and let them know what they need to do for you and make these systems work for you. So I just had to laugh about that a little bit as we were talking about going to DC to get benefits. Throw that in there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they'll show up now. My parents would show up. Along that line, I think the one, as we talk about it, you know, my mother, and of course, being married to my father, he was a similar kind of person. She didn't ever give up on things. She was diehard determined. Anything, you know, I was just thinking about how she was president of the Women's Auxiliary and the National Medical Association. And just she was always doing something and accomplish something and moving up in something. Like she was never just a member or just a person. She was a basilisk for her sorority. She was never satisfied with just being a member. She was always somebody that ended up, this could be good or bad. And unfortunately, it's something that I do think was in the DNA, that somehow whenever you go to do something or get in an organization or a job or whatever, they end up making you in charge. And she was always that. She was always ended up in charge of something, in charge of some progress or something. I'm sorry, project or program. She was always in charge of some project or program, or she was always some officer. Or some leader. And I feel like that has trickled down.
So it was a significant honor for Annie to receive the Congressional Gold Medal. What was your reaction? What was the reaction among you and your family when you found out in March?
The biggest thing that I really regret is that she was not alive to see it. I think she would have absolutely loved that. And it would have made her life. I remember how she reacted when the first Black president was elected. And that wasn't even a personal thing. That was just, you know, all of my life, I've worked with civil rights, and here we are in this position where we have a Black president. And to think now this would be a personal thing. And for her to think that, oh my goodness, you know, all of my life and nobody recognized these things that I did, I think she would have loved it. And I really am so sorry that she wasn't around to experience it.
I would have to agree. I think she really liked to be seen and heard. And so I think that her military service being seen clearly for the impact that it had would have been really, really significant and special to her.
Yes, absolutely.
Courtney, did you want to go back on one of my previous question about reflection on what her life and legacy mean to you?
Sure. So for me, it's tone setting. I knew many sides of my grandmother, some of which we will not discuss today, but I knew many sides of her personality. And I think one of the most important pieces of who she was a leader in so many aspects. A leader, I knew her in her old age, so I only knew certain things. She was still, even as an older woman, a leader in the family. And when she was younger, still a leader in the family, even though she may not have been actively engaged in the workforce when she had children, still very much a leader in the community, and a leader in civic service. So to me, it impresses upon me the notion that no matter how challenging your circumstances are around you, no matter what you live in socially, it is important to make sure you leave your mark and make sure you've done your part. Whatever that thing is that you are able to do, you should be utilizing your talents in a way that contributes to the betterment of the country and of your local community, as well as to the world, despite how that world sees and treats you sometimes.
Amen. I have just a few more questions before we wrap up tonight. So what do you think about Annie's decision to serve her country, given the level of racism that existed at that time? Any thoughts about that?
You know, when you look at the fact that our parents both were very active leaders in the civil rights movement, I guess they kind of always felt like they were going to be movers and shakers and fighters. And I think a lot of Black people at that time, just they knew you were either going to be stepped on or you had to stand up. So they kind of knew what they were going to be experiencing, but they still thought that it was a better situation than sitting around doing menial jobs in the public sector, you know. So You know, I think that just the times people were, they were going to continue to fight for themselves. And look, this is the 40s, and you turn around in the 60s, and then you have the National Civil Rights movement going. So and these are the people, the same women that went over to the military, went over to European theater of operation. Some of them are the same women that came back and did the civil rights movement, worked in the civil rights movement. I've read stories from some of the other women, and it seems like a lot of them did the same thing. They came back home, they became wives and mothers, but they never stopped serving the community. They never stopped fighting for their rights as Black people.
So given where the country is now, do you think she'd make the same choice to serve the nation?
Well, I think if she was young enough, I don't know if, you know, that's hard to answer because people of today have opportunities that they didn't have back then. So what did they have? They had, you could get a job. Chances are it was an unskilled job. Now hers was a little bit more of a skilled job because she took the office secretarial training. But you didn't have a lot of choices. So you could either get a job that maybe wasn't going to fulfill you as a human being. You could get married and hope that you could marry somebody who had a good enough job to support you. But as a Black woman, you didn't have a lot. I mean, they didn't really have a lot of options. And you could go to college if your parents could afford it. But you didn't have a lot of options. And so if you wanted to advance, you had to do what these ladies did. So I think that all these women that we've talked about with the 6888 would have probably done the same thing. We have more options, so the circumstances are clearly different.
I think, though, I mean, like my Aunt Karen, I'm having a hard time pulling her out of her era and placing her today. And so the closest thing I can do is to ask myself that question. Would I make that sacrifice at this time frame for the country? And I'm torn. I'm torn because we have a really amazing country that we live in, but there continue to be over the course of hundreds of years, so many violent acts perpetuated over and over again, or perpetrated towards Black folks. And so it's hard to think about the amount of sacrifice that you would need to make to join the military in such a tumultuous time. It's very difficult to think about making that sacrifice based on all of the things that just the overt violence that we experience. And to be clear, there was overt violence then too, mm-hmm. right? To be completely clear about that. But I think the generation that I belong to, I'm a millennial, and we have very little patience for all of it. I think our ancestors were much more patient and thoughtful in their approaches. We also can be thoughtful, but also ride with our guts and act a little more quickly and strong-headedly sometimes too. There's a shirt that I've seen a lot of folks wear around that says, "I am not my ancestors." And the very interesting thing about that is we are very much our ancestors. We're the product of all of the work that they've put into civil rights and social justice. So our ability to say, "Oh, I'm not putting up with that," has to do with everything that they've already done. We wouldn't even be at the point where we could speak so loudly if those things had not occurred. However, the implication there is also we will not be patient with your stuff that, you know, the continual pain and violence being inflicted upon our community. We will not be patient with that. We will not wait around it. We will not sit for years and allow these things to happen without speaking loudly and clearly and in your face every single day. So, and I think that the other difference between the two generations is social media and the ability of individuals to speak their piece and their platform continuously and influence the masses in a really different way. I think Black folks had to connect in a much different way with limited technology back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, moving into this era. And so I can't juxtapose those two timeframes and drop her into from one to the other because there's so many vast differences.
Mm-hmm. Very, very well said. I have one final question for each of you. What lessons from her life story can you share to inspire young African-Americans to embrace fear as opportunity in order to shatter glass ceilings and be their best selves?
Well, I almost think the answer is kind of in the question. But right, the whole thing that believing in yourself, pursuing your dreams, being persistent, not letting anybody hold you back. I think about some of the experiences that I had in trying to pursue my educational goals. And I will have to say my mother was very supportive through some of the more challenging times. But I think people sometimes give up too soon, or that you just have to persevere, and you have to keep your eye on the goal. And even though things are complicated or difficult or challenging, you just can't accept no for an answer. You just have to keep moving forward and keep saying, well, this is what I want and I'm going to get to it. And I always felt that. I felt that motivation from my parents. And I think if young women stay focused like that and say, this is what I'm going to do, I'm going to make it happen, things will happen for you. Even if you have roadblocks along the way, as everybody has had, you persevere.
Courtney?
You can't let people tell you what you can and cannot do. You simply cannot live by the rules or confines that others will place on you, because they will put absolutely anything on you and a limitation on you that you can possibly imagine that would potentially stunt your growth and development opportunities. People will try it. People are always trying it. And so I think one of the lessons that I would move forward with is you can't listen to those voices. You just can't let them prevail. You can't let that be the tape that plays over and over again in your head at night. You've got to find other narratives, other positive influences, folks ahead of you who have done big things. And if you can't find people who have done things, big things that have come before you, you got to look behind you for motivation from folks who are younger than you to possibly push you into places where you can be a pioneer, because you may have to do it for them. You may be on that long list of firsts. You know, you may not get the benefit of being the 20th person to do this and have a way paved for you. You may have to look behind you for your people coming up behind you for inspiration and motivation as to why you need to venture into these different things and try new things in life and expand your horizon.
You know, when I think about different, because I've read the stories of several of the women, and the one thing that I think comes through with all of them, even with, I've listened to Charity Adams speak, all these women were motivated that they wanted to do a good job. They took pride in what they were doing, and they were going to persevere. They were going to make things work out. These ladies had insurmountable tasks within both France and in England with the male situation, but it was a pride in who they were and a pride in what they were doing. And they didn't think twice about it. Most of them would tell you, if you listen to their stories, hey, I did what I had to do. I made this decision to go in the military. This is what I was assigned to do. And I was going to make it, I was going to make it work, and I was going to do a good job. And they did. And that way of thinking has passed down. And you can't let stuff like what the males would say about the women in the military, or what the white people would say about them in the military. They didn't seem to be fazed by that. They were driven, you know, they had tunnel vision. This is what I'm here for, and this is what I'm going to make happen.
So Karen and Courtney, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight and sharing your family story. I'm really very grateful. And so to my audience, I have a special footnote to tonight's episode. In the interest of full disclosure to my audience, I too am a descendant. Annie Knight Jordan is my mom. So I am that other daughter or the sister that Karen referenced. And I am Courtney's mom. So to the life lessons that Karen and Courtney shared, I would add that from my mom, I learned a spirit of adventure, my interest in global citizenship and world travel, my pursuit of lifelong learning, and my belief that almost anything is possible if you want to do it. And so rest in peace, AKJ. Thank you guys for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Next Us 818 podcast. I hope you enjoyed our show. If you have questions or topics you'd like us to discuss, or you'd like to be a guest on the show, please email the show at nextus818podcast@gmail.com. That's nextus818podcast@gmail.com. I like to end each show with a favorite reflection. Tonight, I will share a quote from Mark Twain to kick off 2023. 20 years from now, you will be more disappointed by the things you didn't do than by the things that you did. So throw away the bowlines, sail away from the safe harbor, catch the trade winds in your sails, explore, dream, discover. See you for our next show on Wednesday, January 18th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. You can catch the show on Anchor, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Amazon Music.